And our special guest tonight, Philip Mantle, will be back with Philip. We'll take your phone calls now on Coast to Coast AM. Philip, where do you get the book Mysterious Sky? How do you find it?
Quite simple. It's on Amazon.
Simple as that. They have everything.
Sorry?
They have everything.
Well, I would hope so.
Let's go to the phones. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Philip Mantle on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Mark Center. I'm Philip's website guy.
Oh, okay.
And I just wanted to throw my props out to Philip for the one keeping the alien autopsy story alive for 12 years. Without him, we wouldn't have gotten this far. And I did want to ask Philip, he knows I'm a stickler on the physical, and you say you have a couple of photos of the original dummy, and I was wondering if those look good.
Good evening, Mark. Nice to speak to you. How's the shoulder?
I haven't gone in for the surgery yet, but it should be a couple more days.
Okay. The photos I was referring to, Mark, were on the documentary that Sky One did. There are a couple of Polaroids. There's about three of them laid together, and it shows you John Humphreys making the original dummy. He made it out of a clay mold, and that's how he made the original dummy. Those are John Humphreys' original pictures. And I checked with my friend who worked on Lord of the Rings and various other productions, a lot of horror movies he worked on, and he said they'd made molds exactly the same way when they did dummies for various special effects. So it is exactly how you would do it, Mark. So there is physical evidence there. You know as well as I do, Mark, and I've confirmed this with my friend, that those that work in this field, the special effects or the sculptures, they are collectors. They like to have a little bit of something that they've worked on, be it a Polaroid or an artifact or a hand they've made or a head. And I was told originally by Simon, he was our first tip-off about John Humphreys, that John had kept the head. He'd kept the head of one of the original dummies. He wasn't sure whether he still had it, but Simon had seen the head. I believed it was either in his workshop or his garage or wherever, but he did have the head of one of the dummies. Now, whether he still has it or not remains to be seen, because as you know as well as I do, Mark, we've not managed to interview John Humphreys in person as yet, but I'm pretty sure one day we will do. So I am confident that there is physical evidence there. We also know from Bob Kiviat's discussions with both John and his business manager, who is a bona fide business manager in the West End of London, that there's also a paper trail, which you could class as secondary physical evidence, for want of a better word, that will lead John directly back to Santilli. Now, this could be contracts, checks, monies, bank account statements, and that kind of thing. But this wasn't the kind of operation that was done, with a handshake over the table. It was all done, through John Humphrey's business manager. It was all legal and above board. So there is a variety of evidence there, Mark, that will lead us to the ultimate conclusion.
Great. I'm glad to hear it all. Get off the phone now. Just check your email. I want to help you out on that special effects angle in the United States if I can.
Okay, Mark. You take care after the operation.
Okay, Mark, thanks for being on the program. You know, I was in a store just yesterday, Philip, and they're starting to put out their Halloween stuff, and they are selling for $34 a head inside a crystal ball type thing, and you touch it, and the head talks, the eyes move and blink. For $34, I'm telling you, this looks so realistic, it's incredible. So you can imagine what Hollywood can do or what professionals can do when they want to make something that looks real and lifelike.
Well, absolutely. And you have to go back to the original Fox documentary with that Bob made. And interviewed on there was, the top special effects guy, Stan Winston. I mean, he's probably the top of the tree. And referring directly to the people he believed on, the man who may have made the dummies. And he said he was so impressed with it, he'd give him a job tomorrow. So that,
I remember that.
Yeah, you couldn't get any higher accolade. And one of the things that John Humphreys had said in some TV and newspaper interviews he'd done here, that was probably the hardest thing for him, was to keep quiet, because he had people like Winston and others saying what a great job he'd done. But as a professional, he couldn't hold his hands up and say thank you very much, and, you know, by the way, could I have a job, you know? And so it was difficult for him to keep quiet as far as that side of things was concerned. But, you know, the things that Winston made, of course, for Jurassic Park were full-size dinosaurs that moved. So, you know, the movie people can recreate just about anything.
If they have the money to spend, they can do it.
Absolutely. The one thing we don't know about the alien autopsy film and the dummies and things is how much it all costs. We've no idea as such. But I'm sure we'll get to it. Again, my friend who worked in the movies, he estimated about, he could have done it at that time for about £10,000, maybe about $15,000. If you're out of work, you know, and that kind of thing, so it's not a huge amount of money. You know, the actual bits and pieces that you need to buy to make these kind of dummies are not that expensive. It's the manpower that would cost you if you had to pay for it.
Well, I'm sure they got their money back 10 times over.
Oh, absolutely.
Next up, first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Bob in Oregon, Wisconsin.
Hey, Bob. Thanks.
Yeah, we're about 7 miles south of the state capital. I wanted to tell you, and I want to congratulate Philip for pumping some adrenaline into this discussion. It's greatly done.
You're welcome.
56 years ago, I was an Air Force sergeant in Wing Intelligence, just a few years after the Roswell information came to the fore. We didn't get a real workup on that. I was cleared for secret documents, but not top secret. Therefore, George, I don't know much about the order to shoot down.
I understand.
Yeah, but all the other stuff came right across my desk. And I was looking at them one day, and there was a document that told of a flight of 3 jet planes chasing a UFO described as a saucer. And the leader of the flight told his 2 compatriots, you guys go back. I'm going to turn off on the burner here and see if I can catch up with this thing. Well, they went back and they called him, and he said, I haven't caught him yet, but I'm gaining a little bit, so I'm just going to keep on pumping it. So he did. Then they heard nothing from him, and he never came back. And this is in the report. And it said that air and ground search crews could find not one scintilla of evidence that his airplane ever existed. They never found a body. They never found anything of the aircraft.
You think it's the prime cover-up?
Oh, yeah, good grief. Back in 1950, they were right on top of it.
Yeah.
Let me tell you another tale here. It's the same office. Colonel Anderson from across the hall was the wing operations officer in charge of all flights, which meant all of the airplanes under our wing commander. He came in while we were discussing this, and my colonel was a good friend of his, and he said, look, Dick, he says, let's don't talk about flying saucers anymore. You remember about 4 years ago when I was a first pilot for Chicago and Southern Airlines, I came up to make a landing, and I was followed by a cigar-shaped outfit with amber lights all around it. I called down and told the people at the airport. I made maneuvers. This thing did similar maneuvers. I could never shake it until I got to the airport. And then when I landed, we got out of the plane. It was a night flight. Everybody was asleep but me and the co-pilot. We saw this thing. We got out as the last 2. We were greeted by 3 guys in black suits, and they said, you saw nothing, you heard nothing, and you will say nothing, or you'll regret it for the rest of your life. He says, I don't want to hear about these things anymore. I believe that these colonels are right. I think Colonel Corso also is right. He had a memo at the back of his book from General Nathan Twining, head of the Air Force, when I was in. And Twining's memo, if you'll dig it up in the appendix, says these objects are real. They are not figments. Treat them as such and report every one of them to my headquarters. Finally, going about 25 years later, my two teenage sons saw a saucer in Pierce, South Dakota. It was nuzzled up to one of those tall electric towers, you know?
Yeah.
And seemed to be drawing juice from it. My oldest son, who was 15 or 16, saw it, told me. He said, Dad, I stopped my car, I looked at it, and all of a sudden a blue or green light came out of it and started heading toward me. He said, I jammed the accelerator down and I climbed the hill. We were on a hillside. And just ran in the house, and I was scared. And his sister said, Dad, he was so scared, he climbed under his bed. He couldn't stand it. Well, his younger brother came by in another car shortly after that and saw a saucer flying away. So he and the older brother got together a few hours later, and they drew a diagram of it. The older brother saw the top of the thing. My younger brother saw his younger brother saw the bottom of it. They drew a diagram. Our next-door neighbor was an FBI agent. We took it over to him and described what had happened. He said, I will take it out to Ellsworth Air Force Base in Rapid City, and we'll find out if they spotted anything.
Did he?
Of course, the Air Force said nothing.
Yeah.
We didn't see anything. But my son saw it. Hey, all this evidence all the way back to 1950, and people are still saying, hey, are they real? I knew back in 1950 they were real. These are incontrovertible evidences, these kernels. They aren't lying, but as Philip said, you got to have hard evidence. All I can give you is, I guess, it's not apocryphal. I'll just give you this oral evidence. I believe in them, have since 1950, and I keep wondering why this stuff is all shut down.
Is it shut down, Philip, or can we just try to leak it out once in a while?
Well, I don't think it's shut down at all. I mean, it's great what Bob has just had to say there. I mean, it emphasizes exactly what we were talking about earlier, George, about the military. We only know the tip of the iceberg, quite literally. And they were told to keep quiet. You haven't seen anything. You saw nothing. And it still goes on today. I think it's more out of embarrassment than anything else, whether it's anything official. But, you know, it's the tip of the iceberg. How many more people like Bob are there out there, both from the 50s or even today, who have seen these things firsthand? You know, we talked about, you know, pilots and aircraft disappearing. I mean, one of the most, you know, famous pilots perhaps of his time was Gordon Cooper, you know, who became astronaut Gordon Cooper.
Oh, sure.
And Gordon Cooper had his own UFO sightings whilst he was a pilot in flight in Germany. And later he went on to say that, you know, he had film in his hand of a UFO landing at a military base in the United States. He didn't view the film, he didn't see the landing, but he had the film in his hand. And he went on the record quite categorically saying that UFOs were not of this world. He became astronaut Gordon Cooper. So it's still there, it's still happening, and thankfully there's still people like Bob who are willing to go on the record and say, look, when I was involved in the military, this is what I saw, this is what I experienced. But there's a whole lot more out there that haven't gone on the record, and it would be great if they would.
As a matter of fact, Bill Burns is going to be my guest Tuesday night as we talk about Philip Corso and the day after Roswell. Very compelling information.
Absolutely.
Next up, let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Yeah, this is Glenn from Nashville.
Glenn, thanks for calling.
Ask your guest, I worked at the Nevada test site in the early 60s, had a high Q clearance, and when Russia set off that megaton bomb they set off into Siberia, we had pictures of that device that was taken with a reverse-engineered UFO that we had. And did he ever hear anything about that? Because we knew that they didn't have a rocket that would get that thing off the ground at the time, and yet we was carrying around 220-megaton bombs and planes.
Never heard anything about that particular incident at the time. I mean, like anything from the Soviet Union, it was locked tight. I mean, it was only those that, the higher echelons of the U.S. military that knew what was going on there because of the spying and the satellites and so on. We poor people in the UFO research community knew virtually nothing. Like I said, one of the outlets for material from the Soviet Union was Dr. Felix Siegel. I mean, he was locked up at one point. He was imprisoned for it. You know, but a few of his books, sneaked out through whatever means and were translated into English. So we got to know very, very little. If, compared to what information was there, we got to know absolutely nothing that was happening. And it's one of the reasons, like I said, that Paul and I decided to write Mysterious Sky, was to try and get as much information out there as we could to show, the bravery. And I use that word correctly, the bravery of Soviet UFO researchers. I mean, there's no UFO researcher that I know, certainly in the UK, that would ever have their life threatened because of their interest in this subject, no matter what they did. But these people literally did face the death penalty at one point. It's hard to imagine here in the West, but they did. So that's another reason for writing the book. But we heard nothing about that particular incident at all, Glenn.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate it. Let's go to West of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hi there. Hello? 1, 2, 3.
Hello?
There you go. Hi.
Oh, George.
Yeah.
Trucking through Louisiana, and I really enjoyed your show. I've been listening to Art a long time, and then been listening to you since you've been on.
Thank you.
I have a video at home with Chuck Harder and Stan Freeman. They were going over the Alien Autopsy movie, and they both seemed to think that it was both made on an old film roll camera that would have been used in that particular era we were supposedly made.
In 47. Yeah, you may be right about that.
Absolutely. I mean, I'd like to interject that it was filmed with a film roll camera. And it was used 16mm film, which you can still obtain today. I mean, one of the things that John Humphrey said is that they went to great lengths, planned it meticulously to make it look authentic. And one of the ways to do that was to use the same type of camera equipment that was used during the era. Same with the artifacts you see on the film, like the knives and the surgical instruments and the clock on the wall and the phone. They were all circa 1947. But one of the things they didn't want to do was to get them from a museum, because they would have looked old.
Good
point.
They had
to look as if they were the original at the time.
And somebody might have said something.
Absolutely. But they did use, again, a Filmo 16mm camera to film the alien autopsy film, because had it been filmed on anything else, we would have been able to spot it straight away and it would have died a death. But it was filmed with an old Filmo camera, but filmed in the 1990s.
Did Santilli do this all for money?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the film itself has made millions, and I mean that, millions, the world. It was shown in over 20 different countries. He licensed it off to each different country. I mean, just in the United States alone, I believe Fox paid something like $250,000.
Gosh.
And then there was the video release, of which Santilli had royalties from the video release. And you have to remember, in 1995, I think it was the biggest selling documentary of the year, something like 100,000 copies, and he had a share of that. So, they paid $60,000 for it to be released in France in a magazine. And you multiply that around the world. I mean, just do a Google search and punch in and see where the video, all the DVDs still on sale. I mean, it's still on sale everywhere around the world.
All right, Philip, stay with us. We'll be back with final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Well, our next program, it'll be Friday into Saturday, and you know what that means, open lines. And who knows who's going to check in with us on that night. Do you believe our astronauts? I know that Edgar Mitchell has talked about his belief in life in space, but he has never admitted to me, Philip, that he saw anything or was followed by a UFO. But do you think our astronauts have seen something?
Oh, undoubtedly. Undoubtedly. I mean, you know, I know Buzz Aldrin has perhaps tried to retract his statement that he made recently, but he's gone on the record. And, you know, once you've said it, it's too late to retract it. And I mean, we talked about Gordon Cooper. He saw something when he was a pilot, you know, and he later became an astronaut. But I have no doubt about it whatsoever. I mean, we've got some little bits and pieces of film footage, more so from, you know, the various shuttle missions that show UFOs in space, whatever UFOs are, that are anomalous objects in space. So I don't doubt it whatsoever. And I think that any documentary that can get to a number of the astronauts and actually interview them, whilst they may not admit to anything of a personal nature, I think his story, Musgrave, talks about the worms he's seen in space, and there are some film up these little things that wriggle around. I think they would all, to a man, more or less, say that they have no doubt that life elsewhere does exist off-planet. I think that would probably be universally accepted by them all. So, yeah, I've no doubt about it whatsoever. I mean, it's you know, as Buzz Aldrin said about the time of their sighting, you know, one of the reasons they didn't go public or didn't say anything on the air to NASA at the time is because they were worried that, you know, they were on their way to the moon, that it would get cancelled. And they think, you know, these guys have gone nuts, you know, bring them home before they had a chance to land.
Yeah, what's doing that to them?
Absolutely. And we also have to remember, whether you're an astronaut or a guy, you know, working on the bus or wherever, there is still a great deal of stigma attached to this subject. It's not as bad as it used to be, but there is still a great deal of stigma. If you stand up and say, you know, I've seen a UFO, and this is what it looked like, and this is where I was, it can have an adverse effect from people making fun of you to people thinking, well, should I promote this guy? You know, you know, this type of thing. So the stigma is still there. However, I think certainly over the last 10 years that has been reduced to a large degree, because we had people like the late Dr. John Mack, Harvard professor, on the record. Here in the UK, with people like Nick Pope from the Ministry of Defence. I mean, Nick was the MOD officer who investigated UFOs for 3 years officially. Gone on the record, you know, stated his own, you know, not just talked about his work, but his own beliefs as well. So I think that has reduced the stigma somewhat, because these are people who have, again, more to lose than they have to gain by doing this. I mean, Nick has been promoted at the MOD, so it's not done his career any harm, because, you know, he's told the truth. And it did have, for a while, have a detrimental effect on the late Professor Mack. I mean, I believe, you know, Harvard tried to sort of investigate him to see if he was worthy of being on the faculty, but he was proved to be, you know, all above board. So, you know, I think, you know, the stigma has reduced. And you know, we've just had a caller from Bob, you know, from the military, going on the record. And I'm sure others will do it as the time goes by. You're going to be speaking about Bill Burns and Colonel Corso. And thankfully, before Colonel Corso died, he went on the record. And he is who he says he is. He has a long and distinguished military career. More to lose than he had to gain. Simple as that.
That's an incredible story all by itself. First-time caller line, good morning.
Well, good morning, George. What an honor. My name is Stacy. I've been listening to you guys for so long. Before I get to my question, though, I do have a question personally for you. Do you like to dance, George?
Do I like to dance?
I was prompted by Tom to ask you that question.
Oh, good old Tom.
My question is, UFO phenomenon has been going on for decades, for so long. It's been even in the mainstream media. My question really is, has there been much advancement as far as national attention, something that finally our country, our government, overseas or not, has to address? I mean, it's overwhelming, the case studies and witnesses and testimony over the years and piles of paperwork on this. I was just wondering if anything is going to happen because of this. Is anybody going to actually address it?
I mean, it has been addressed before, but it's all been swept under the carpet. I mean, it could. Is it Stacy, did you say?
Yes.
Stacey, one of the reasons why you may not see anything from, you know, the President, our Prime Minister, Tony Blair, whoever, I mean, it's an argument that's often put forward, is that the powers that be already know what UFOs are. So they don't need to do any more. Maybe there's not a lot they can do about it. They are powerless to act, that the UFO phenomenon, by and large, is no threat. same as, you know, us floating around the moon aren't a great deal of threat unless we crash again, you know. So it could well be that the powers that be are aware of the phenomenon. They know a great deal about it. It isn't a threat to mankind. There are those that claim they're in cahoots with, you know, the beings from another world. I'm not totally convinced of that myself. But it's like anything.
Right, but by sweeping it under the carpet, doesn't just that take away from their credibility altogether?
Well, that's something you'll have to judge for yourself, Stacey. I mean, these are your leaders. You elect them, same as we do here in the UK. So that's something that you'll have to, you know, make up for yourself, whether you think it destroys their credibility. On the other hand, they could be as dumbfounded as the rest of us and don't know what to do.
No way to really explain it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think UFO research has done a pretty good job. The vast majority of it is done by people like myself with no money, with no resources. I'm not a PhD. I have no degree. I am just me, who, for whatever reason, became fascinated by this subject, wanted to get to the bottom of it. And I think when you add all that up, we've done a pretty good job. Imagine what we could do if we had resources, if we had some money, and we had time to dedicate to this and do it correctly, do it scientifically. I mean, you know, the potential is enormous. And if it is aliens from another world, then, you know, it opens up an all-new ball game. And I think it's something that I've been asked time and time again. If the president or the head of the UN or the Pope, whoever, went on national TV tomorrow and stood there with an alien and said, you know, here they are, they're here, we know all about them, what effect would it have on mankind as a whole?
Or well, the philosophy of a person is smart, but people are stupid. You scream fire in a full theater, it's going to be crazy.
Yeah, I could only say what it would affect me as an individual. I would still have to go to work tomorrow. I would still have to feed my kids. I would still have to pay my mortgage, you know. So the everyday things certainly wouldn't change as far as, you know, Joe Public is concerned. I still have to do that. But there would be bigger ramifications. Would it upset the religious churches around the world, for example? What would it do to the financial institutions around the world? You know, the world is run on oil, whether we like it or not. If we've got vehicles coming from A to B some other way, what then does it do to that?
Good point.
We've got a new power source that, you know, oil disappears tomorrow and we can, you know, plug or whatever in and off you go. So it has all different kinds of ramifications that could upset a whole host of things. But me as an individual, I still got to go to work in the morning. So something to think about, Stacey.
Stacey, thanks for your call. As far as the question about me dancing, well, you just never know. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Hi.
Oh, George Norrie, you're doing great work.
Thanks.
This is Tom, Seattle, Washington.
All right, Tom.
Hey, I just had one question for your guest.
Okay.
And I'm going to cut to the quick.
He's ready to go.
Where in the world are these hotshot attorneys ready to take on anybody, anywhere, anytime, so that people who want to come forward can get protection? What is going on with
like the whistleblowers? Protect the whistleblowers.
Exactly.
Well, one of the places.
What is the legal protection?
You've
what
got that
the
in the United
community?
States. You've got it there. There's an organization called the Citizens Against UFO Secrecy.
Cause.
And it's run by bona fide attorneys. We call them lawyers and solicitors. Attorneys. They have tried to sue the government every which way but loose, have had some success in getting documentation released and so on. But if there is a whistleblower, if you were a whistleblower, they are there for you. They can do it all for you, and it won't cost you a penny. Simple as that. So the protection is there if people want to come forward. But so it's there. It's as simple as that.
Tom, thanks for your call. We'll take a few more as this quick night is rapidly coming to an end. Wildcard line. Hello there. Where are you calling from?
This is Wade from Vancouver Island.
Hi, Wade. Go ahead, sir.
I think I sent you an email with regard to a UFO that I thought I saw when I was quite young. Probably 11 or 12 years old, and it was an elongated triangle that swept across the sky, and all I could see was reflected sunlight. It was that high up. It was an odd experience for me, And when I pointed it out to my father, he didn't believe me.
That's par for the course for a lot of people.
Oh, I know. I know. It was kind of crazy. But
and of course, you're not alone in seeing the triangles at all. I mean, in more recent times, some of the most famous sightings around the world came from Belgium, and they were of a triangular object. Now, a lot of these were witnessed by the Belgian gendarmerie, the police, and there is one very, very clear photograph of this triangle with the three lights underneath. And you even have the Belgian military with state-of-the-art aircraft trying to intercept these flying triangles. And whilst they never managed to intercept them, what they did do, they got radar lock on, both airborne and ground radar, and there it is on radar. And it's there for all to see, and it dropped from a huge height to a few hundred feet in a matter of seconds. Such a maneuver would have killed any human pilot with the G-forces. So you're not alone in seeing the triangles. They're still around.
Do you believe, Philip, actually believe that these extraterrestrials have been in contact with governments? They have some kind of reciprocal arrangement? There's some kind of communication going on?
I would have to say this, that if the UFO subject is of an extraterrestrial nature, and we'll take that issue on for the sake of argument, we'll assume it is, and that the few sightings that remain unidentified are flying saucers and have occupants in there from another world, they have been around longer than since 1947, for an awful long time, then I think it's only logical to assume that somewhere along the line there has been interaction with the leaders of our world, be it the presidents, be it your military officials. I wouldn't doubt that whatsoever. I mean, we go back to the Rendlesham incident that I mentioned in 1980 here in the UK. It is said by some that there was interaction there between the occupants of this craft and the military officials that were there at the time. So, yes, I'd have to say, if we are dealing with an extraterrestrial phenomenon, I would have no doubt that that may have happened or should have happened somewhere. With whom? I couldn't pinpoint to any one particular person, but you would have to assume, you know, the highest military officials and even, not necessarily, but even up to, you know, presidents. No doubt about it.
East of the Rockies, your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, George. Hi, it's Steve from Pittsburgh.
Hi, Steve.
Hi. I have to agree with your guest, though, what he said earlier about the government and why they don't acknowledge it and say there's an elephant in the living room, because what's the big deal? We have to live every day and just go on with our lives. But I have a quick story about Puerto Rico. I worked with a man down there at the airport, and his wife went out one time with her sister to a country house, and they sat on the porch looking out over the hills, and they heard a loud humming sound and saw this large silver dome come rising up over a hill. Well, they panicked and ran inside the house and locked the door. The next thing they heard was footsteps on the roof, and the next thing they knew, they woke up in the bedroom facing each other across the room. And an hour had gone by from 4 o'clock to 5, and they had no idea what happened.
Lost time, abducted case.
Yes, that's it. Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thank you. Appreciate that. We didn't have enough time, Philip, to get into abductions and what's been going on over in the former Soviet Union. But as you admitted briefly at the beginning, it is happening.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the skeptics will try and tell you that people who experience, you know, the abductions always experience them in some remote vicinity and there's never anyone else around and, you know, they're a little bit off the wall. Well, that's not the case. The abduction experiences take place here, there and everywhere via a cross-spectrum of the community, from a doctor to a pilot to, you know, a road sweeper to a, you know, construction worker. Quite literally, whatever these experiences are, you know, they happen here, there and everywhere, including in the cities, in rural areas, in the towns. Again, most of the people who have these experiences don't want to go on the record. They simply want to put it behind them. They want to forget about it. But like the rest of the UFO subject, there are a number of brave individuals willing to go on the record because they believe this is important, that people should know about this, that this is happening. They don't necessarily say they've been abducted by aliens. They say, I had this most bizarre experience, and this is what it is. Again, the skeptics will say, oh, it's all the result because they had hypnosis. Well, that's not true. I think of roughly about half of abductees never go anywhere near hypnosis. They can remember everything. They don't have to go near a hypnotist. You know, they don't have to have hypnotherapy or regressive hypnosis. They can remember it. So, you know, the whole UFO subject and certainly abductions are questions waiting to be answered. And these are the questions that the skeptics can't ignore. I mean, we have a new magazine in the UK called UFO Data, UFO Data. And it's available at ufodata.co.uk. And basically, it's an information. We put these information out there. And we've got an article now about Gordon Cooper and his sightings and some of the other things at NASA. And they're all questions waiting to be answered. We know a lot of them. We've answered a lot of the questions. A lot more to go.
Whatever happened in the Ural Mountains up there?
Well, we mentioned earlier that certain areas around the world that seem to have, they've been nicknamed window areas, for want of a better word, that seem to have concentrations of paranormal phenomena. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Not just UFOs.
You're almost done, Philip. You're almost done.
The Urals is one of them. The Ural Mountains has everything you can think of. It has paranormal phenomena, the UFO sightings. It's there. It's one of those window areas. It, literally, everything has happened.
We have that here with Mount Shasta.
Absolutely. We have it here with the Pennine Hills of northern England. It's in the Hest Island Valley of central Norway, and so on. It's around the world. There are these window areas, and the Ural Mountains are another one of these.
We've got time for one more quick question. Let's go to our wild card line. I only have about a minute for you. Go ahead, please.
Hey, George, this is Jason from Texas.
Hey, Jason.
Yeah, me and my dad were coming back from a job around midnight, and we stopped at this car dealership to, like, look at some trucks. And, like, in the back, there had, like, a whole bunch of new trucks that had just came in. And I swear, me both and my dad, we saw an alien or creature or something jumping on the cars, like on the hoods of the car. And I like freaked out.
Where did he go? He just kept hopping on them?
Yeah, he hopped on it and jumped over the like building and just vanished.
You know, I get a lot of calls like this, Philip, that people go camping and they see these creatures everywhere. They are strange stories.
Absolutely. I mean, there's one here from the northeast of England that I remember vividly. You know, a chap just driving to work the same route he'd done every morning, and there was a goblin running along the side of the road. It was raining.
Everywhere. Man, unbelievable. Philip, thank you. We're out of time. Mysterious Sky, Amazon.com, right?
Yeah, and ufodata.co.uk.
You got it. Philip Mantle, his links are up there at coasttocoastam.com. For Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Dan Brady helping out this week, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there in Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.